You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
So we're going to be talking about developing a healthy view of failure. And I also subtitled this Developing Grit. You know, so really what we're going to be talking about is how to go through failures, be able to learn from them, and be able to persevere through hard times. I was thinking about it because this past month has been really wild for me. My husband was away on a business trip for a week, and during that time, like, my kids all got crazy fevers of, like, 103, and then my daughter developed this insane staph infection in her leg. And we are still treating that. It turned out, like, no antibiotics were fixing it. They have her on stuff for, like, MRSA at this point. And today, we're going to decide if we need to take her back in and, you know, what do we need to do? But I was definitely feeling like, oh, this is my fault. I should have, like, cleaned it better. And all of these things were happening in my head, and I was like, I just want to crawl in a hole right now. Oh, wait, but I got to go teach on having grit. And so that means I have to keep going. So here I am. So developing a healthy view of failure. I have noticed as my kids have gotten older, this is something that comes up more. I have a daughter who is in fifth grade, a son who is 8, he is in second grade, and another boy who is in first grade. He's going to be 7 in 2 weeks. And as they've gotten older, I've seen, you know, through friendships, there's more nuance and difficult situations they have to go through. In school, they're learning more difficult material. They're having to balance, how do I handle these projects with these other things? How do I handle, you know, sports practice when I have all these other things going on? And so there's these bigger opportunities where they could shut down and fail, or they could run away from problems, or they could pretend like they're not there, or they could blame it on other people, or they could learn to grow through it. And so that's why I picked this topic, not because I'm an expert, but because it's an area I really want to grow in, and I want to learn how to help my kids with that. At Calumet, where I work, these two books were handed out as reading material for the summer. And I found them very helpful, and so I'm just going to basically quote these a lot and then talk about some personal examples. The first book I'm going to talk about is Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance by Angela Duckworth, which is a great last name, and The Gift of Failure by Jessica Leahy. So let's go ahead and get started. So I mentioned this word grit, but what is grit? Well, in this book, The Power of Passion and Perseverance, what she talks about is these two categories. So she, Angela Duckworth, is a psychologist, and she started to interview people that just had this kind of, this grit is the word she uses for it, but this perseverance. And so she starts with this West Point problem that they had, the College of West Point. They take in the best of the best. This is like the Army College. And what they noticed is, at the beginning of college, before they start, they have to go for this camp. And during this camp that has the best of the best people in it, so many people end up dropping out. There's like this huge percentage don't actually make it to West Point. So they tried to figure out, what is it about these people that didn't work? You know, is there something we can look at that says these people are going to succeed at West Point and these people aren't? A way that we could just maybe shorten the process. And they looked at natural ability. Are there certain people that are just more naturally good at things? Nope, that didn't determine who made it at West Point. They also looked at, you know, are there people that have more skill than other people in areas? Does that determine who's going to succeed? And it didn't. So she begins to just interview all of these people who made it through West Point and notices consistencies among them. And so she says, what is grit? She narrows it down to these two things. The first is perseverance. And the definition of perseverance is just persistence in doing something despite difficulty or delay in achieving success. These people were just able to power through no matter how hard it got, no matter how difficult it seemed and how much they thought they may fail. But then also, they had passion. And I think passion is a word we can misconstrue. Maybe we think of more like this fleeting, like intense feeling as passion, like in the throes of passion kind of idea. And that's not what she means by this. She interviewed people who had consistency, where they were like, man, I have loved cooking since I was a little kid, and I still care about it. Or mathematicians who were able to stick with the same problem year after year and still loved it. And so her definition for passion here is a sustained, enduring devotion. And so this is what makes grit. So she also continued this, and from these observations, she created a test to determine how gritty you are. And I passed this out. I printed off some copies. It's a simplified version of her grit test, but this is in the book. But if you want to, you know, figure out how gritty you are, you could go ahead and take that test. It also talks about how to score it. But she created this test through different questions that kind of modeled the answers that these people gave. But she continued her study and has kind of continued to work on this test, but also just what does it mean to be gritty. And through these interviews, she talked to the Seattle Seahawks coach, Pete Carroll. And so when he talked about grit, he put it this way: do you have a life philosophy? For some of us, the question makes no sense. We might say, well, I have a lot of things I'm pursuing, a lot of goals, a lot of projects. Which do you mean? But others have no problem answering from conviction. This is what I want. Everything becomes a bit clearer when you understand the level of the goal Pete is asking about. He's not asking about what you want to get done today specifically, or even this year. He's asking about your passion. Now, she goes on to talk about in this that you can't know your life passion at the age of like 8. You know, I'm not expecting my son to be like, this is my life passion here. That comes with life experience. That comes with trying things and figuring out what your interests are. There's a lot that goes behind that. But these people that have grit in adulthood, something that is consistent is there's this overarching goal. There's this thing at the top that kind of directs everything else that they care about. She puts it in a chart like this. It kind of shows a hierarchy. We have this goal at the top and then all these other ones that kind of branch off from it. So at the bottom of this hierarchy are our most concrete and specific goals, the tasks we have on our short-term to-do list. These exist merely as a means to an end. We want to accomplish them only because they get us something else we want. So that's the very bottom of there, the low-level goals. You know, those are our day-to-day things. But in contrast, the higher the goal in the hierarchy, the more abstract, general, and important it is. The higher the goal, the more it's an end in itself, and the less it's merely a means to an end. She also makes the point that, yeah, this chart only shows, or this picture only shows 3 levels, but there might be a lot more inside of that. You know, there might be more layers in that mid-level section. You might even have more than one main goal in your life, main life philosophy. She talks about how she has her career set. You know, like, this is my main goal for my career, but her family life is separate than that. So, but this is the general idea. And so when she interviewed these people that have grit, this is the way they view their goals and their purpose. There's this zoom out. They're not focused in on one thing, but rather they zoom out and can see the big picture. Now, she continues to talk about what happens, though, when one of those goals doesn't work. You know, the person that has grit, it takes flexibility at the lower levels in the goal hierarchy. The low-level goal with the angry X there in the picture, that's a goal that has been blocked. It's a rejection slip, a setback, a dead end, a failure. The gritty person will be disappointed or even heartbroken, but not for long. Soon enough, the gritty person identifies a new low-level goal that serves the same purpose. Apparently, that last word disappeared. Same purpose, period. So they can look at that and say, yeah, this hurts, that didn't work, but what's another way I could do this to achieve the purpose I need, which is the higher goal? But I think a lot of us struggle with that. And instead of that hierarchy that I just showed, what we end up seeing is this, where there's just a whole bunch of really big, important goals. We're just like, you know, yeah, I have this thing that I care about and want to achieve, and this thing, and this thing, and they all feel equally big and equally important. But what can happen with that is this, where when we have a failure, it's kind of like this magnifying glass on that failure because they all feel equally big and important. So that failure is really big and it's really important. I don't know if you guys have seen this movie, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. This is what it made me think of. So the movie is about this scientist who decides to build a shrink ray in his house with adolescent children, which he leaves unattended, which is a great idea. And so they end up shrinking themselves. But I wonder if that's how it can feel for our kids. Oftentimes when they experience failure, the magnifying glass is on it. And instead of being just this small thing that happened, this small setback in their life, it becomes this scene, which scared the crap out of me when I was a kid. You know, this bee, it's just a normal bee, right? It could sting you, but nothing more. But no, you know, this kid's shrunk and that bee is huge. You know, it's bigger than you can imagine. It's terrifying. And I wonder if our failures can feel like that to our kids. You know, they experience a setback and it feels like that, the giant bee coming at them. So, moving forward, what is grit? Continuing that, what she also talks about in this book is we don't have to feel stuck, that this is something we can develop. And she talks about it's something you can develop from the inside out, but also the outside in. In these four different areas she works through, which is interest, practice, purpose, and hope, which I am not going to talk about, and that's my teaser to read the book and learn more about that category. So that is what grit is and how we can encounter failure in a healthy way and develop that perseverance. And I think that this is a biblical view. You know, I'm talking about two non-biblical books I read, but this is throughout the Bible too, this idea of grit and being able to learn through our failure. You know, when you read 1 Corinthians 9, Paul talks about this. He says, you know, I do all things for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings. That is his big aim. That is his life philosophy. That is his top of his goal hierarchy there. It's all for that. And he says, do you not know that in a race, all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Therefore, I do not run like someone running aimlessly. I do not fight like a boxer beating the air. And he goes on in this description. But the point is, Paul says, I'm willing to go through everything and continue because I know what I value and what I care about. And Paul went through a lot of setbacks. You know, he goes through a list in another letter that he wrote where he was beaten, he was persecuted, he was run out of cities, he was arrested, he was shipwrecked, he starved. You know, those feel like some pretty big failures that would make you want to quit and make you want to shut down. But he did that all and continued. And later on in his life, he writes one of his last letters before he dies, and he's like, I fought the good fight, I ran the good race. Where he's like, yeah, at the end of the day, I met my goal. I did the best that I could do. And I think we're able to do this because the Bible says that it's not, you know, we don't have a magnifying glass on our failures. Instead, Ephesians 2, 8, and 9 says, for by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not of yourselves. It is a gift of God, not as a result of works, so that no one may boast. You know, God does not put a magnifying glass and see our failures. If we have a relationship with him, if we've said, I can't do this myself, God, I want you to take charge, what he sees is Christ. And it's not our failures. And so we don't have to encounter them and be afraid, like, this is what people see about me. This is who I am. No, you are seen as Christ. And we see through Peter too, I'm not going to read this section, but just kind of summarize it. One of Jesus's disciples, Peter, had a big failure. You know, we see that he had these bold claims. He's like, I will never abandon you, God. Jesus, I love you. I would never abandon you. I'll die for you. And then when Jesus is suffering, what does he do? He denies even knowing him because he's scared for his life. And so that was a big point of failure. And Jesus helps him see that. You know, when he sees Jesus later, Jesus is like, hey, do you love me? And Peter has to wrestle with that. And he asks him multiple times, like, let's be honest. Let's look at what happened. Let's look at your failure. And then he's able to say, tend my sheep. You know, take care of my flock. Love the people that I love and take care of them. And Peter became head of the church in Jerusalem. You know, God used him in big ways because he was able to see his failure, honestly look at it, and grow from it. And this is the kind of person I want my kids to be. I want my kids to not be perfect. I want them to make mistakes. I want them to fail. But I want them to be able to look at it like that and have it change their character and make them more like Christ. So what gets in the way? You know, what are the things that we do that can get in the way of our kids developing this grit or this healthy view of failure? And I think the first one is emphasizing talent and natural ability. You know, how often do we say, like, man, you're so smart, or, oh, look at how good you are at that sport. Look how hard, you know, you're so good at it. I was thinking about this. So I played violin in school, and that was my major in college for a good while. And when I was younger, that was what I heard all the time. Like, you know, all my teachers or, you know, my parents were like, oh my gosh, you're so talented. You're so gifted. And things just came to me naturally with it. And I was able to do really well. And, you know, and that was just what I heard all the time. And I would compare myself to the people around me. And I had, you know, my friends, you know, music nerds, we gather together. And I would compare myself and be like, wow, you're just really not, you have to work really hard at this, and it doesn't sound as good, you know? And I would compare myself. But looking back now, I burned out. I haven't touched my violin in 15 years. I don't play anymore. I got burned out. I grew to hate it. It didn't stay my life passion. I did not have grit in violin. But some of my close friends who I compared myself to and thought I was so much better than, they have thriving music careers, and they are doing so well in that. Yeah, it was not about talent and natural ability. So we put our children in the same sports, and we do a different sport every season. And this past season was wrestling season. And my daughter, she is a naturally gritty person. She's really good at it. She's a go-getter. She kicked butt, which I love, because, you know, I love seeing a girl do something that you wouldn't think a girl would do. Now, my son, my middle child, this is not his strength. He is not an aggressive person. This is not natural to him. He did really good at wrestling last season just because of his height. He's in second grade, but he's the size of a fifth grader. Like, not, you know, this way, but height-wise. But this year, it was really hard. And wrestling is a difficult sport. Like, this is a you against one other person. You are on a team. But you go to these tournaments, and there are four teams at this tournament. You've got two auditoriums full of people watching. And it's you against another person on a mat with literally an entire auditorium of parents that are sometimes insane watching you. And so my son stood on this mat and got pinned time after time. And so 2 weeks ago, maybe three weeks ago, we were at a tournament. And he's having a hard time. He gets pinned on the first go. And then the second match is going on. And these two men sitting in front of me, these grown men, are just laughing and making fun of my son. I ended up like patting him on the shoulder. I'm like, that's my child you're talking about. I'm gonna need you to be quiet or go sit somewhere else. And I had this moment where I just got like really embarrassed, not of my son, but for my son, where I was sitting there thinking like, oh my God, like, how must he be feeling right now? Like, he's not naturally good at this thing, and he's getting laughed at. This sucks. And afterwards, I went up to hug him. You know, he got pinned, and he had a couple tears in his eyes, but, you know, nothing too crazy. He wasn't, like, all out crying. And I go over, and he was like, Mom, did you see I made the first drive? Like, I took the first attack. I was like, yeah, it was really good. And he was sad, but, you know, you could tell he was sad. He was like, I got pinned again, you know. But he kept going. He was willing to get back up for his third match, and he pinned the kid for the third, you know, the third go. And I was like, man, why am I feeling embarrassed for him? He should feel so proud right now. Sorry, I'm going to get teary-eyed. Love my kid. Yeah, he showed courage. He was willing to get up there and get, you know, get him pummeled by another kid, get hurt. You know, he had scrapes and burns on his, you know, rug burns on his body, and he kept going. And then last week, he got first place. Yeah, it was very cute. Okay. All right, I'm going to stop crying now, and we're going to keep going. So, the point being, I was emphasizing his talent and natural ability and being like, he doesn't have talent in this. He's not naturally good at it. But man, was he courageous. I think another way we can get in the way of our kids developing this is jumping in too soon. So I have a couple cheesy pictures here. I'll talk through them. The first one is chores, or like things that we're doing, our kids are trying to do around the house. I think this is a way that we can hinder them learning to have grit or perseverance. We can jump in too soon. Maybe we're like, you're doing that wrong. Do it this way. Do this step, then this step, then this step. And we try to give them the play-by-play for everything they're supposed to do instead of letting them try to figure it out. How does it work for them? I think we can also just jump in and be like, you're doing it wrong, I'm gonna do it instead. Also, I think homework, I don't know if a lot of you have kids that age yet, but it comes fast, like first grade is when they start getting homework. And I think that's a way we can also jump in too soon. Like, did you do your homework yet? Let me check it. You're doing that wrong. Let's fix this. I think another way is I have a picture of a lunchbox here. The point of that is I work at Calumet, and you will not believe the amount of times kids forget their lunch and parents stop everything they're doing and go deliver that lunch to them. Which I've done that for my kids, but I think there's a point where we're getting in the way of them learning. You know, being able to say like, oh, what should I do differently next time so I have lunch? You know, they're not gonna die from missing one meal, and the school will give them a granola bar. They will make it, they will survive. But how are we hindering them taking responsibility if we're constantly going and dropping off their homework that they forgot, or dropping off their lunch, or dropping off their gym shoes? You know, there's a lot of ways we do this. But all of those, I think, get in the way of them developing grit and learning how to succeed through failure. So how do we help? What should we do to help our kids grow in grit and learn how to deal with failure? I think the first one is developing goals. Now, like I said, I don't think our kids are capable of having this overarching life goal, but I think there's a lot of goals we can help them set along the way. You know, there's a lot of character goals. Think about the different areas that our children have in their lives. You know, friendships. What are goals we can help them set to become a good friend? What do they think a good friend looks like? And what's a goal they could set in that? What about being responsible? Being diligent? You know, there's these different areas where we can form goals. I think another important one in this is the small wins. That's what we call it in our family, and I think ultimately that's really the lower-level goals, like the day-to-day things or the small things. But with our kids, we call them small wins. So even with like the wrestling analogy, we gave him three small wins where we'd be like, hey, buddy, what are going to be your three small wins today at this tournament? And he would even ask for those. Like he'd be like, hey, what are my wins going to be today? And I think that really helped him persevere through his failure. So we can identify the small wins for our kids. I think there's a lot more independence ones too when you get to the school age. You know, what would it look like for you to be a responsible student? And yet again, I agree, it's very, very based on personality. Like the goals that my daughter sets, hers are more you need to let go, like set a timer. And when that timer's over, we are done. Like you are not worrying about school anymore. You are not finishing anything else. My boys are a little bit different. they're not, you know, as structured. So yeah, I think that would be a good thing to think through and maybe talk to your spouse about, like what are the age-appropriate goals for your child and where they're at now? Think through, what are they like? But yeah, we'll keep going. So goals, that is a way that we can help them in this area. And then also guide towards a solution. Now, these are things that I pulled from the book, The Gift of Failure. Both books talked about goals, but Guide Towards the Solution, this was from this book, The Gift of Failure. I want to make the point, you know, we don't want to throw them into the deep end. You know, we want them to come up with their own solutions, to, you know, to suffer consequences and learn and all of that, but we don't want to just throw them into the deep end of the pool and say swim, right? There is a lot that we have to do to kind of build them up to that, help them build routines, help them build structure. You know, like, yeah, with the getting dressed, like she was talking about, like, how can we help them figure that out? Oh, what do you do first? You open your drawer, you're going to pick out your underwear, your pants, your shirt, you know, what do you put on first? You know, we don't want to just say, figure it out, toddler. You know, we help them. She says in her book, she gives some examples here. I know you know what 5 times 3 is, so what happens when you add another 5? We're not just going to give them the answer. How do we help them get there? Why do you think the cold glass broke when you poured hot water into it? Try holding the protractor. I don't even know how to hold a protractor. So you can read the numbers right side up. Parenting is teaching, and teachers look for teachable moments in just about everything we do. Find those moments and lead your child towards answers. So, yeah, we want to guide them. And then she also says here, don't rescue them from consequences. You know, when they encounter a failure, don't save them from that. Here's another example of some ideas she throws out. It's no big deal that you dropped the glass. I'll show you how to clean it all up, and you can remember to carry fewer next time. Or pick out the lumps in the oatmeal, and I'll show you how to avoid that mistake for next time. Or the mop bucket spilled because it's too short to hold the weight of the mop handle. Just clean it up and use the other bucket next time. You know, in those examples, she's not freaking out and saying, oh my God, you got water all over the floor. Oh, there's broken glass everywhere. It's this calm just like, yeah, you messed up. Fix it. How are you going to fix it? What are you going to do differently next time? She says, if we show our kids that mistakes are part of the process of learning, they'll be more positive about their abilities and better able to bounce back from mistakes in the future, or in future attempts. If we teach them that messing up means the world will crumble around them, we only succeed in reinforcing fear of failure. Later on in the book, she talks about it again and says, your offer to rescue actually implies that you don't believe he has the ability to find a solution himself. Help him problem solve and find lessons in the failure rather than viewing it as a devastating blow to his self-image and confidence. Your goal should be to help him regain a sense of control over the experience of failing. The real learning happens when your kids begin to understand how to pick through the wreckage, find the pieces that still work for them, and devise a strategy for the future. So at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is build their confidence. We're trying to help them see that they have competency in an area. And it builds them up for the next mistake. I think, too, we have to be willing to give feedback. Feedback before, but also feedback after. Here's her examples. Look down at your buttons. Something looks off. Can you figure out what's wrong? If you forgot to carry the 2 in that other problem, maybe you made the same mistake in this problem. You know, it's questions. It's making observations. She says effective feedback supports effort and guides the child towards seeing her mistakes. Kids value supportive observations that encourage them to solve their own problems more than specific directions because the solutions are their own, not yours. So, you know, when I'm helping my daughter with her homework, I need to stop saying, well, you got that wrong, you know, like that's not helpful, but rather, oh, did you check that? How could you check that answer and see if it's right? Yeah, and then also using a growth set or growth mindset language. Both books talk about this. This is a chart from Grit, some examples that she gives of language. I'm not going to read it. I'll maybe say one or two of them. But fixed mindset comes from the fear or the failure book. But I think it's the same idea. This is the one that I thought was most important. You know, a fixed mindset would say, this is hard. Don't feel bad if you can't do it. But the growth mindset language would actually be, this is hard. Don't feel bad if you can't do it yet. The idea being we can achieve competency in any area if we try hard enough. Like, we don't have to feel stuck. Yeah, maybe it seems hard, but if you work hard enough, you can figure that out. All right, so basically we are trying to help them build competency. And here's 3 areas that she talks about in The Gift of Failure where we can help them learn from their mistakes and build success in a way that they feel competent. The 3 areas are chores, sports, and homework. I'm gonna mainly talk about the chores one because I think that's where most of us are probably at. But I printed off, and I don't know if everyone grabbed it, but I printed off a paper in the back that kind of lays this out. So if you don't have to take pictures of this or whatever. But she goes through, in this book, age-appropriate chores. So I wrote them down here. But toddlers, for example, here's the things that they should be able to do. This would help them build competency. You know, they should be able to put their dirty clothes in a hamper, put their toys away, throw away trash, follow simple 2-3-step directions, feed the dog or cat. That's a good job there for a kid. I would throw some other things on this. When my toddlers, you know, as soon as they were able to walk and, you know, had some fine motor skills, one of the things we did was teach them how to buckle themselves in the car seat, where it was like, here, we're leaving, we're going somewhere. What's the first thing you do? You open the car door, you climb in the car seat, you snap here, you snap in these, and then mommy comes and tightens you down and makes sure it's safe. But I think that's another one we could throw in there. Another one is preschool. What are the age-appropriate preschool chores? Making their bed, straightening their room, putting silverware away from the dishwasher, watering the plants, clearing the table, not freaking out, but learning how to clean up their own messes, their own spills, preparing their own snacks. When my kids were in preschool, they learned how to make their own mac and cheese. Like all steps, turning on the stove, boiling the water, putting the mac and cheese or the noodles in, setting a timer. The only part I intervened for was straining it. That was mom's job. But other than that, they could make their own mac and cheese. And then elementary age. At this point, they should be able to prepare meals. That means they're going to be able to chop things up. They're going to be able to follow cooking instructions and make their own meal. They could cook dinner for the family at this age. Clearing the table, laundry, all parts of it, not just putting it away. They should be able to run the wash machine, the dryer, folding their own laundry. You know, we have folding parties is what we call it in our family. Every Sunday, they get to watch a movie and we sit there and they have to sort all the laundry and fold it all and put it away. And that's our party. It's very fun in our family. Vacuuming, mopping. They should be able to vacuum and mop their room. Helping plan and prepare grocery lists. Like our kids, I am so sick of making meals that my kids are like, ew, I don't want to eat that. So they have to pick out the dinners that are approved by me and dad. They have to figure that out and what would we need. Middle school. She makes this point, so I'm not even going to bother reading this one. Middle school and up, she couldn't think of a thing they shouldn't be able to do. They should be able to do everything by that age. So chores, this is the big way you're going to help them build competency. And I think sports fit in here too. Sports can help them build competency. We want them to learn how to stick it out, right? I don't know about you, but I've had kids, one of my kids is like, oh, I don't like this sport, I want to try a new one. I don't like this sport, I want to do a new one. Is it because they don't like it, or is it because it was hard? Is it because they lost? And I think we need to be able to evaluate that. I tried to put my kids in soccer. I tried to be a soccer mom for a hot minute. It is not for our family. We are not soccer people. Their first game, like I realized my son looked like a deer in headlights. And I was like, oh, I've never even showed him a soccer game before. He had literally no idea what he was walking into. Or my daughter, she tried hard for a minute. And then she like literally sat in the field and started picking dandelions. And yeah, I was like, well, I'm going to say we don't have to stick this one. We're going to finish the season because we said we would. We're not going to do soccer again. But one of my boys kept saying that it came time for a game and he was like, I don't like this sport. I hate it. I'm like, man, you look so happy in practice. Do you actually hate the sport or are you scared? You know? So we have to be able to pick that out and figure out, is this one we're going to stick out and keep trying because it's building character growth? Or is it one we can move on from? I think that through this, kids can learn how to lose well. And there is something nice about team sports for this because they're not on their own. You know, it's not like that wrestling example where they're on the mat and if you lose big. Team sports are kind of nice because it's like, yeah, maybe you lost, but all your friends lost and you're in it together. There's a camaraderie there. And I think it's good because coaches are really good at helping kids set goals in this area, helping them find those small wins. And then finally, homework is another way we can help our kids build competency. As someone who works with fourth grade, I would just like, you know, start thinking about this now. A lot of us aren't at this age yet, but when it comes to homework, please remember the purpose of it. It's not that your kid gets everything right, okay? The purpose of homework is for them to practice skills they've already learned in class And also, it's a good assessment for us of where they're at. So it's okay if they don't get it all right. It's okay to get a paper back and have wrong answers on it, to not get a perfect score on it, because ultimately it's a good assessment of where your kid's actually at. The amount of times I've graded papers and I'm like, man, this kid really gets this math unit we're on. And then it comes time for the test and it's like, oh no, they had no idea. It's because mom and dad were helping them with the homework. So remember, the purpose of it is for them to practice skills and to show where they're actually at. You know, help them learn how to organize things well, how to set up good, you know, good homework skills, be at a quiet place, set your desk up right, set a timer. I think that is really helpful. You know, if they don't finish it in that amount of time, that is fine. They can write a note and say, Mrs. or Mr. So-and-so, I was stuck. This is as far as I got. That is okay to do. And also ask questions. Don't tell them where they're, you know, don't tell them where they're wrong or how to fix it. Ask questions to help them figure it out. I made it through. That was it. So that is how we can help our children. And there's a lot more. So please read those books. I think it's good to read earlier rather than later too. I'm wishing that I'd read these a little bit sooner for some of my kids. So, all right. Well, God, thank you that you love us and see us not by our failures, but if we know you, you see us as your child, as you see Christ. And thank you that you don't see our kids' failures. You see what you created them to be, and you want to help them grow in that. So I just pray that you could help us think through, ways that we could come alongside our children as they go through this and let them really learn through their mistakes. Amen.